Hello and welcome to All Else is Commentary, a podcast of Jewish ideas. I'm Rabbi Elliot Karstadt, and in this episode I'm joined by Keith Kahn-Harris, who's a sociologist, a Jewish researcher, and one of my teachers from when I was a student rabbi at Liebert College. We're talking about his new book, which is called Everyday Jews. We talk about the power of the mundane and how he thinks Jews should aspire to be more parochial. Keith, thank you so much for joining us on All Else's Commentary. It'd be great to just begin with the core argument of your book, which is called Everyday Jews.
Thanks for having me on here, Elliot. I really appreciate it. The core argument of the book is that Jews are hurting at the moment from their significance. That whether you love us or you hate us, we are so much in the public eye. We are so much crucial to major controversial debates in the world today that we are losing, or certainly in danger of losing, a sense of mundane, everyday Jewishness, the kind of Jewishness that is kind of taken for granted, that carries on and isn't particularly glamorous and can sometimes be a bit mediocre, sometimes be less than exciting, even boring perhaps. So the book makes the case that that is the case and suggests some ways out of this predicament that we've got ourselves into.
And how much was the book prompted by, you know, you say it's based on where we are at the moment. How much was it prompted by the 7th of October and events since then?
Well, I was already thinking about this book before October the 7th happened. As I explained in the first chapter, a lot of the book was provoked initially by a Holocaust trip I went on a few months before October the 7th, 2023. But everything really crystallized after October the 7th. That's when I wrote the book proposal and started to have a clear sense of what it was that I wanted to argue, what need I felt was urgent that I wanted to fill. It wasn't so much the terrible events of October the 7th, although that was certainly traumatic, as it was for many of us. It was this awful feeling of being exposed to public scrutiny, of being in the limelight, which was so excessive and has been so excessive that it made me worry about what impression non-Jewish people would have about what it is to be Jewish. A very distorted impression, perhaps, that being Jewish is a source of anxiety, which it can be, or a source of enormous drama, which of course it can be too. But it isn't just that. And so I also watched as Jews from right across the political spectrum in Britain and elsewhere fought for the public eye, as did the State of Israel. And it seemed to me that there was something about that that was potentially compromising, which doesn't mean, of course, that I didn't think of the October the 7th attacks and the war that followed and everything that followed that as being trivial or irrelevant or something we should just shut up about, because no, clearly it was a big thing. But it seemed to me that part of the negatives of that attack, aside from the lives lost and the hostages taken and so on, was also broader than many of us were thinking about at the time, that there was something else we were losing that constituted maybe a different kind of existential threat.
And that thing that we were losing, it seems to me from your book, was a sense that we could just go under the radar, that we could just go about our normal everyday lives unnoticed without having to worry about or justify ourselves to anyone else.
That's part of it. But I think it's also about Jewish life in a holistic sense. That it's not just that Jewish life doesn't just come down to Israel, to anti-Semitism, to these big themes. Clearly that's part of it. Of course it's part of it. But it's not the whole thing. and that there's a lot of other stuff that often gets unnoticed that makes Jewish life. And if we take out that other stuff or we cease to value it, then something problematic happens. It certainly distorts the images that non-Jews may have about what it is to exist as a Jew. So I suppose it was that sense that the holism, if you like, of Jewish life was being eroded in ways I thought were quite disturbing at times.
Mm-hmm. And let's get into some of those little details. One of them was Kiddush wine.
Yeah, I mean, look, the book sounds very serious, and it is serious fundamentally, but there's a lot of it, there's a lot of playfulness in the book, as there will be, or has been, depending on when you people hear this, at my book launch on 11th of March at JW3. There's a lot of silliness and playfulness in the book, and a certain amount of humor as well. Not that it's a comedy book or anything like that. I'm not actually a comedian, of course. So one of the things where I talk about Kiddush wine, and British Jews often do talk about Poland, just as American Jews talk about Manischewitz, is the extraordinary thing that many of us celebrate the holiest day of the week with something incredibly substandard that we will do with by choice. And I think that opens up a whole world of Jewish mediocrity that I've become fascinated by. The idea that often the most Jewish things we do are often the most mediocre things we do. And this seemed to be important to draw attention to, for actually, aside from the fact that it's quite fun to do so, because if you looked at the way Jews are talking about, whether you're an anti-Semite or a philo-Semite, you'd see as Jews are extraordinary. You know, like the contribution we have made to the world is extraordinary. But we're also capable of being a bit rubbish, of being not very good. And it's often, paradoxically, in our most intense Jewish spaces behind closed doors that we give free rein to this mediocrity. So Paulwin is an example of that. It's much loved, but it is no good. And in fact, the point is it's not good. The point is that this is homely. It's Hamisher, to use the Yiddish. And there's a lot of that about in the Jewish world that it seems to me to be quite modestly subversive and certainly educative, because it doesn't really fit well with the image that Jews often project into the outside world.
So one of the examples that you give of that is of Jewish architecture and Jewish space as well.
Yes, and I think that's quite a British argument. I don't think it applies so well in America. One of the things I actually quite like about British Jewry is that most of our buildings are fairly utilitarian. We don't spend our communal money erecting extraordinary buildings. There are a few. But most aren't. If you look at the new Alis building, and you look at the new Finchley building, they're decent buildings, and they will last a long time, and they've been designed to do that. But they're not extraordinary. They don't delight the soul. And whilst part of me would like that some of the time, that utilitarianism can get a little bit grey. It strikes me as both, again, a corrective to the idea that Jews are extraordinary, but also focuses on what's important, on the everyday use of those buildings, rather than being stunned by them. Of course, sometimes we go beyond utilitarian to the mediocre and even awful. So I grew up in Radlett and Bushy Reformshul, which in its early years was a small growing community. And we were in an old, well, it's still there. It's an old church that's in Radlett High Street. And it was until we'd actually raised the money to turn it into somewhere more pleasant. It was pretty horrible and mildewy and musty and just not very nice. But the fact is, my youth at Radlett and Bushy Reform, I have very warm feelings about it. It was my home. It was my community. And I don't think the two are completely disconnected, right? There's something about mediocrity that there's a place for everybody in mediocrity. And I also made that argument of the Israel that I grew up with, which is very catty around the edges.
Very much under construction is the impression I got from reading the book.
It wasn't just that it was under construction, although some of it was that. It was a very half-finished or a quarter-finished as a country. But it was also a country where, in certain areas, art and culture was actually pretty ropey, to like in film. Or in certainly in popular music, but there was, and certainly in food, Israeli food was very uneven, to be polite about it. But I could fit myself into that world, even though I didn't quite like it always, in the sense that it was often a bit uncomfortable. Whereas now Israel is it's not finished because nowhere is finished, but it certainly has extraordinary things in it, extraordinary arts and culture. It's very shiny, often amazing. I mean, Israeli food in Tel Aviv equals any cosmopolitan city in the world. But that coincides with a much bleaker political prospect and a sense that this is not a place that there is a space for me in, because it is, even though I know it much better than I did then, even though now I actually speak quite good Hebrew, it's a place that, even if I was Israeli, I wouldn't necessarily feel this was a place that was open. So there is a value to mediocrity that I think we neglect at our peril.
And one of the things one of the ways that you say we potentially can ameliorate this is through seeing Judaism perhaps more in terms of a hobby.
Yeah, I mean, to some extent that bit was a little provocative, well, or a lot provocative, but actually it doesn't actually involve a lowering status of Jewishness so much as recognizing the power and importance of hobbies rather than being trivial and stuff like that, that it often provides a center and meaning to people's lives that is not always recognized the way it should be. So, you know, we joke about train spotted, but that's something that is the center of people who choose to do it. It's more than just a way of filling the hours. It has something important to it. But I think by raising the status of hobbies up a bit and raising the status of Judaism down a bit, you can meet in the middle and find something that is perhaps a more useful way of looking at what it is to be Jewish.
Right, because you talk about one of the memories that stuck out in my mind from the book was of when you were in the early days of Radler and Bushy Reform Synagogue, of putting up and taking down all the things for the holidays, and you and your parents often being one of the last ones there to take things down. And you said there's nothing really particularly Jewish about carrying a box to a van. And there are lots of other people who do that. You know, I was recently at some friends, and they were in an amateur production, and they did exactly the same thing. They had to put up the set and take it down and take it to the van. And so I suppose you're pointing to those kind of things when we're talking about everyday things and schlepping, as we might call it, that ultimately there's nothing particularly Jewish about it, except that the content, like the purpose you're doing for it, is Jewish.
Well, I suppose I'm trying to raise the status of that, but also to recognize that whatever Jewishness is, it often, you, when you break it down, it's to loads and loads of people doing some quite boring stuff. That that's particularly true if, like you and I, you work in the Jewish community, or if you're a bit of a maha and you're a volunteer or a synagogue chair or board member or whatever it is. There's a lot of dull stuff to do. I say in the book, for example, that 2 days after October, so actually it might have even been the day after, what did I do? Well, I spent a lot of the time at one of my employers, the Institute for Jewish Policy Research, arranging the travel for a meeting that we were going to have in Brussels, right? And that is what Jewish life breaks down to. But the problem is it's sometimes seen as, well, all these things are just a means to the end. They're instrumental, they're utilitarian. I'm trying to suggest to not ignore these things. They may have a value they may have something about it that is more central to the meaning of Jewishness than we might think, and also makes us closer to other kinds of things like amateur dramatics than we sometimes might recognize. I mean, the fact is that in the amount of doing, I call it in the book the Jewish way of doing. The more you do, the more the ultimate ends start to become misty and disappear even. And I say that with Haredi Jews a lot. Haredi Jewish life, ultra-Orthodox Jewish life, it is just this incredible blizzard of minutiae, 24/7 almost. That doesn't mean it's meaningless, but it does mean that the wider goals, the wider meaning of it, isn't there every single second. How could it be?
Although I think there is also a strain of thought within, and it's not necessarily in the whole of Haredi life, but there's a strain of mystical thinking which definitely elevates some of that minutiae to a level of cosmic significance. So by lighting the Shabbat candles, by removing the challah, right, removing that small amount of the bread on the Friday night, has this cosmic effect that somehow it moves the divine in ways that big actions and big behaviors don't. So then there's also that idea there within Haredi life that says even these tiny things are incredibly important, not necessarily to us in our realm, but to God ultimately.
Yeah, no, that's certainly true. That in a way, that's what strictly Orthodox Judaism is about: is imputing extremes of meaning into almost every action during the day. But what I'm saying is you don't necessarily experience that meaning. Maybe a few number of highly adept mystics are able to get to that level, maybe. But for most of us, there is a flow to everyday existence that precludes the constant reflection on what it actually means. In fact, I think it would be extraordinarily difficult, if not damaging, to live that way. As I say, other than a few mystical adepts who maybe could approach that.
Even as a rabbi, I spent yesterday doing all kinds of very mundane things, which were very, very, which were actually also very meaningful at the same time.
Yes, although there's, of course, one of the differences between strictly Orthodox and other denominations is that rabbis often, in the strictly Orthodox world, often don't have many responsibilities like that. Or the responses they have may be about learning or making halakhic decisions and that sort of thing. So they're not often the shliach tzibur, the service leader, which you are a lot of the time. They probably don't have to deal with boards. They've probably got doing those sorts of relatively dull things.
I was thinking of doing the laundry. That was what I mean, the laundry and...
I think of the laundry. Well, you know, I mean, but that's also to do with gender roles as well. A rabbi, the rabbinic profession until relatively recently, whether that was Reform or Orthodox or whatever, was often dependent on the women taking that stuff off your hands. But even then, I mean, we think of someone like Hugo Grin or whatever, right? Any of these great rabbinim in our denomination. What did he spend most of his time doing? Well, probably a lot of the time doing, he was having been called out at short notice to go to a shiva or chairing meetings and stuff like that. That's really a lot of the ballast, if you like, of what being a rabbi is.
Yeah. But the other thing to bear in mind about those things, though, is that although no one's amazed that you do it and no one's enthralled at it when you do it, if you didn't do it, you'd soon know that people were not pleased with you, right? If those things don't happen, then that's a big scandal.
They do. I mean, I think one of the predicaments of a lot of work in the Jewish community is, well, I talk in the book about my dad being chair of the ritual committee at, he's now a member of Aleph, but he was Radlan Bashi Reform. It's the sort of work that he did. I did it for years and years and years. And it was pretty much only noticed when things went wrong. Right. And when it went right, it was almost a way you almost disappear. A couple of people who knew would think to say thank you. But there's a certain pleasure in that. There's a certain self-effacing pleasure in being invisible as well. That can be enjoyable for us, for the right sort of person.
Well, actually, that leads me on to my next question, which is, does one's response to your thesis, or whether you call it a thesis, your argument, depend partly on someone's personality? So I'm thinking that there are lots of people who I know, congregants, friends, acquaintances, who, for whom the everyday is the most important thing already. And there are others for whom it's always important to find bigger meaning, deeper meaning. It must be part of a bigger story. Everything they're doing must be part of a bigger story. And so I wonder how much that is has an effect on how people approach. I don't know whether you found in talking to people about this, if there are some people who are very, very happy just to say, yeah, all those everyday things, they're the most important thing, or there are people who are just resistant to it and just won't, and I won't accept it, and whether that's a kind of a personality thing, or if you think they're people can be persuaded.
I mean, I think that the book is not the answer to the Jewish prophet or a recipe book for everybody. It's not intended to do that. It's a fairly polemical, although hopefully reasoned and nuanced, polemic about, directed to Jews as a collective at a particular time, fully aware of the diversity of the people, of the Jewish people, their different identities, and also different personalities. I think what I'm particularly interested in, though, is less people's individual tastes, so much as the image that we are presenting to the world, our collective existence. So in some ways, the book is aimed more at Jewish leadership and opinion formers in some ways, than the everyday Jew in the street. Although perhaps it's also a sense that the everyday Jew in the street needs to recognize this wider process and think about it and maybe try and contribute to it. So, this is not about saying to individual Jews with individual personnel, this is what you need to be doing, what you're not doing, what you should be doing more. What I would say, though, is that there is sometimes a prioritization of a particular kind of Jewishness, certainly within the Reform and Liberal movements, and in different ways elsewhere as well, that maybe is a bit biased in one direction rather than another, that seems to suggest that without that big, grand guiding vision, we're going to lose people. That is ultimately the most important thing, is setting out that vision and exciting people with it and getting people on board with it. And I'm skeptical, although not completely dismissive about that. I think that the necessity of grand visions of being Jewish, they may be less important than we might think. And that's a message in part to the progressive world in which, you know, I teach, and which I've been involved in, which I've been a member of, that seems to be heavily invested in the idea of vision and excitement and all that sort of stuff. And often with an assumption that without that, we will dissipate and we will disappear and stuff like that. And I think those assumptions do sometimes need to be challenged, if not completely overturned, because there's an element of truth in it. Of course there is.
And do you think that's a particular symptom of being progressive? That there is a worry that without the, for want of a better word, coercion or moral coercion of the Orthodox Jewish world, that people will just feel no problem in abandoning ship and leaving and losing interest in Judaism?
I think there's a particular insecurity in progressive Judaism. I think that's certainly true. Sometimes justified, sometimes not justified, in the sense that because we are not reliant on that moral coercion, unless we have a bigger thing, then people aren't going to come to shul and do the everyday stuff and do the dull stuff. Then there needs to be some bigger sense that there is something on the horizon. I think it also comes from a sense that the ambiguities of progressive theology and thought are a bit of a problem and don't play very well, and that we need to, if we can just fix on to the thing that excites people, then we will be guided into the future. I'm not sure it's quite as important as that. I think that a lot of successful Jewish synagogues and other organizations, and actually non-Jewish organizations too, often attract people, often display their vision in what they do rather than what they say about it, right? They don't just simply setting a good example and being somewhere that is convivial can be as attractive as any kind of vision or mission statement. And I think that's true even within the progressive movements at the moment. The successful things that we do may not be successful because of anything that's explicitly said about them, so much as the fact that they work well. They are their own exemplars, if you like. So it is one of the things that generally, there's a bigger picture here. It's not just about Jews or synagogues or the progressive movement. It's also about, we live in a world of mission statements and vision statements and things like that. And I'm not saying they're completely pointless. They do sometimes have a purpose. But I think there's a lack of appreciation of just doing things, of showing a vision in practice, if you like.
In your book, you talk about the particular person who you interviewed for a different project who described themselves as a happy hypocrite. And I just wanted to spend a bit of a moment, if we can, on her, and not specifically on her, but on that idea of a community being made up of happy hypocrites. So people who know that what they do doesn't necessarily match up with what they say they want to be, but who are actually fairly happy about that. And you suggest in the book that it's not sustainable for people to be able to be those happy hypocrites. But I wondered how they fit into your overall argument. And
no, I don't think that was what I was saying. I don't think I was saying that. I think I was saying, so that just to start the meeting, this actually appeared in a report in 2004 in some work I did called Beyond Belonging that was published by UGIA, which was an interview study of moderately engaged Jews. And this was a woman in Leeds who was a member of an Orthodox synagogue but was not Orthodox practicing, that classic Minhag Anglia kind of thing. And I say in the book that when I was growing up, that sort of thing used to drive me mad. In the way that often young people don't like hypocrisy. Hypocrisy is the worst sin. As I've got older, I'm kind of okay with it. That there's something resilient about it. There's something about it that anchors people in Jewish life for all practical purposes. And I think in the progressive world, I think a lot of what we do is based on the assumption that there needs to be this sort of close fit between our ideologies and what we do. But sometimes we need to challenge ourselves and think that actually the ability to hold that disjuncture may have more value than we actually think. So I'll give you an example. This is an article I haven't yet written, because I don't know who would publish, but it would be an article that would be directed at young anti-Zionist Jews who fantasized about community synagogues that would be more in tune with their anti-Zionist values. But actually, what they should be really working for is communities, synagogues that have an anti-Zionist ethos, but most of the congregation doesn't care and is Zionist, right? That's what it is to be normative. Right. And I'm not sure I want communities where everybody is marching in pace to the same ideology. I think there's a certain power to people going along and devoting themselves to an ideology that they don't really pine up to. And I think I'm not sure how Jewishness could survive without at least a degree of that, regardless of what denomination you're in.
Yeah. No, it made me think of the political scientist David Runciman, political theorist, with his book on...
He's wrote a brilliant book about hypocrisy.
On political hypocrisy, where he talks about these two different types of hypocrisy, and that normal everyday hypocrisy is fine. It's the hypocrite who says they've come along with the answer to hypocrisy.
There's a degree of hypocrisy that is fundamental in some ways to who we are. The dangerous bit is people who say, I'm not a hypocrite. Although not everyone is, I have to acknowledge that.
And particularly in this time with the particular person in America who does exactly that, right? It says, I do exactly as I say I'm going to do.
Well, that's off the scale dangerous. But a woman in Leeds driving and parking around the corner from an Orthodox synagogue is not the same as that.
So you spend quite a bit of time in the central chapter of the book talking about popular culture and TV shows and films and the way in which they present Judaism. And one of the keys to the argument you make seems to be that they present Judaism in a way that is not completely unrealistic, but contains unrealistic elements, which therefore diminishes the role the everyday plays in Judaism. Have I got that right?
Yeah, that's a pretty good summary. I mean, one of the interesting things about, particularly in American TV, is that, but also British increasingly as well, is you have a lot of Jewish creators, a lot of people who intimately know the Jewish world. And what's interesting is what they are leaving out, what they frequently leave out, what they are faithful to in terms of accuracy, and what simply doesn't matter. And one of the examples I use in the book is Friday Night Dinner, which I love. I think it's hilarious. Many other people love as well. I have no quarrel with the show. And in some ways, it captures certain things about British Jewry brilliantly in terms of speech patterns, in terms of identities, all that kind of stuff. It works brilliantly. But there are various things that it's just striking that they're not there. So the Hullers there, the wine's on the table as well. You never see them either saying the word Shabbat or making brachot, right? And it's not impossible. Some people do have challah and wine, but don't say brachot. But, you know, it's a little odd. But there's one episode in particular where the boys are asked to be pallbearers at a Jewish funeral. Now, pallbearers do exist in Jewish funerals in some countries. Sweden and the US, I've heard. Do you know? It never happens in Britain, ever, in a Jewish cemetery. That is completely unknown. Not, you know, I don't know if there's a halachic reason or not. It doesn't really matter. But so why would you be so faithful in some things, but that is the sort of thing that you're not faithful about? Because, of course, the episode where the boys are asked to be pallbearers is extremely funny. But why is it that there are some boundaries you can break for comic effect, whereas others that you wouldn't? And I think of other examples of this as well.
There's the example of the marvelous Mrs. Maisel and the rabbi in the tallit at the wedding party.
Exactly.
Which seemed very similar to, I don't know if you saw the more recent TV show, Nobody Wants This, where essentially a very similar thing happened with the rabbi.
I couldn't cope with Nobody Wants This. I last seen like 2 or 3 episodes. But it's often to do with rabbis, in fact. It's often, you know, there were some various bits that I cut out for word limits. Another one was the Coen brothers' film, A Simple Man, where, like, and granted it's a surreal film, but there's it clearly a conservative synagogue where men and women sit together, but that synagogue somehow has a senior rabbi who looks like a Haredi rebbe, right? You often see that the rabbis often look in a certain way. And this is the important thing, is this is not by people who don't know better. These are people. Robert Popper, who wrote Friday Night Dinner, knew better. And I'm not saying he's evil for doing it or anything like that, but I think the thing that's often left out is the sort of mundane details of Jewish doing. It's the sort of the more vague stuff about Jewish being that people are often faithful to, Jewish creators are faithful to. I do actually think that I kind of would love to see more Jewish culture that engaged with the mundane details of Jewish doing. It seems to be astonishing to me that nobody in Britain that I know of has really explored the comic possibilities of committees, Jewish committees, and God knows there are a hell of a lot of Jewish committees. But it's interesting why that hasn't happened, because there are other things that are seen as more interesting, as more in the way we present ourselves to the world. And often that involves presenting ourselves as though the Jewish condition is one of fascinating neurosis. And there's an element to that, sure, that is partly who we are. But, you know, it's not all we are. We don't just exist, we also do things.
So in some ways, we may need our own version of Rev. I don't know if you saw the Rev with Tom Hollander as a inner city priest, and the moments when he's having to drink all the communion wine because he didn't get enough people for communion. And those kind of, is that the kind of thing you mean?
Yeah, perhaps, although I can't really judge its accuracy because right. I'm not a member of a... But I like the fact that it was a dull, decaying, presumably CV church. I think that was really, really useful. I do doubt that the CV could pay for not just one, but there's also an assistant curist and stuff like that. That doesn't seem very realistic to me, but it may well be realistic. I don't know what they do all day.
Well, so were there any TV shows or films that you felt actually did manage to do that kind of pulled it off in a way that was really honouring of those everyday things?
Well, I don't want to say no, because I'm not, it makes me seem incredibly arrogant, but it may be to do with the fact that I maybe don't have a look, maybe I haven't looked hard enough. I think the literature is often more expansive in the way it deals with things than film and TV. It's very hard to get films and TV made. It's quite challenging to get stuff that's more mundane there. It's not that there's nothing realistic out there. There is. It's just realistic to certain aspects of being Jewish than others.
So there was the one that I was thinking of was in fact Shrugim, which was the Israeli TV show about modern Orthodox Jews, and that was made by modern Orthodox Jewish.
All right, you're cheating there by mentioning an Israeli show.
But you know, you mentioned Stiesel in the book.
I do mention Stiesel, although I do actually say that, in fact, that Stiesel has a diaspora-type inaccuracy to it, in the sense that you very rarely see people davening, and Haredi Jews in Jerusalem daven a lot. You don't see, they sort of play down a lot of the stuff that Haredi Jews do. Not completely. You only see it when it's broken. So there's one episode where Akiva Stiesel suddenly realizes he's missed davening Shacharit for the first time in his adult life. But most of the time, you know, if you weren't Jewish, you think, oh, do they pray every morning then? You know, so, but yes, I haven't seen Shrugim. I'm told it's like that. But you would expect that in Israel, because they have a whole film and TV industry, that they would be able to show some of the breadth. Whether they've showed anything about Reform Judaism in Israel, whether there's a show about that, I don't know.
That's a very good question. I don't think so. No more than there is in the UK and the US, where there's many more Reform Jews.
There was a BBC Radio 4 show, like I think in the 90s.
Oh, yeah,
The Attractive Young Rabbi. I never listened to it. Maybe it was good. I mean,
I don't know. I've seen it. It's actually, I think it's on BBC Sounds. So maybe we should do a listen to it and have them do another podcast about it.
Well, I have to.
If we can find the accuracies and the inaccuracies. I say, to just to kind of bring us to a close, what are the kind of the final recommendations that come out of your book?
Well, look, it's not a policy-oriented report with an appendix with a list of bullet points that Jews should be following. I think that some of this is for Jewish leaders to try and reconsider how certain things are done. I think that, and how we do public events, and how we publicize those public events, particularly things like, there's a chapter in the book about Hanukkah and the way that I think it's gone a little bit out of control, the degree to which this is now something that we invite non-Jewish people to, and in the process completely disguise the true nature of what Hanukkah actually is, which is it's not really a universal festival at all. It's highly particularistic, almost as much as Purim is. So it's partly about those priorities. I think that certainly there are not explicit bullet points for the reform and liberal and now progressive movements. But I think it's pretty clear what I'm suggesting in terms of what we emphasize in the merger of the reform and liberal synagogues, that the whole vision thing may be a lot less important than people actually suggest. But I think for the rest of it, the sort of thing I'm recommending is learning to observe and to treasure those everyday aspects of Jewishness, and also not despite those ties when they're mediocre, but perhaps because they're mediocre. So develop, I think, a kind of parochialism, to make parochial no longer a dirty word in the Jewish community or in society. Not that we should be completely inward-looking, but that maybe it's time to look to ourselves a bit more than we have been doing in recent years, and to perhaps reconsider what we value, that we don't have to be so important that it's fine for us to just keep on keeping on. In fact, there's something wonderful about it. As I say, not a list of bullet points.
Thank you, Keith, for joining us on Analysis Commentary, and thank you for challenging us. I'm not sure that I agree with everything that you've talked about, or everything's in the book, but it's really good to have what you're saying as a kind of reminder, because I think that those things, like the everyday, is incredibly important, and those mundane things that we do as Jews that people hold on to and that are part of our collective consciousness, like Corwin, are really important. So thank you so much. And we'll put a link to Keith's book in our show notes. It's called Everyday Jews, and it will be available from
13th of March 2025.
And a reminder of that launch at JW3?
The launch of JW3 will be on 11th of March. You do need to book, but you'll be able to try Paul Wing cocktails that are created by a member of Aleph, Reuben Simon.
That's all for this episode. Thank you so much for listening to All Else's Commentary. A reminder that tomorrow, the 4th of March, I'll be recording another episode with Rabbi Kath Vardy, and this time it's a question and answer about the stories we've been studying together from the Talmud. If you have any questions for the two of us, please email us at allelseis@aleph.org.uk, either as text, or you can send us a voice note if you want your voice on the podcast. You can also join the conversation on our Facebook page, and we're also on Blue Sky, so please head over there to give us a follow as well. If you've enjoyed this episode, please check out our other episodes and subscribe wherever you get your podcasts. I want to thank Keith Khan-Harris for joining me in this discussion today, and we are incredibly grateful to Ada Synagogue for enabling this new podcast to be a reality. Please listen again to All Else's Commentary, a podcast of Jewish ideas from a curious, progressive, and critical perspective, brought to you by Aleph.